Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, and today I will be solo, no guest host, but I have some great guests, starting off with Ralph Peters. Ralph is a strategic analyst with Fox News Channel. He's a writer, strategist, commentator, and retired military officer. He is the author of 24 books and almost 1,000 columns, articles, essays, and reviews. A uniformed service, personal interests, and research have taken him to 70 countries and 6 continents. He served in the U.S. Army for 22 years, first as an enlisted man, then as an officer, retiring shortly after his promotion to lieutenant colonel to write with greater freedom. As a soldier, Ralph served in infantry and military intelligence units before becoming a foreign area officer specializing in Russia and surrounding states. He has published 6 books on strategy and military affairs. Additionally, the Marine Corps has published a compendium of his research reports from Africa written between 2003 and 2006. Also a novelist under his own name and as Owen Perry, he has written a number of bestsellers with international settings, as well as prize-winning historical novels about the American Civil War. His new novel, The War After Armageddon, which takes the U.S. Armed Forces back to the Middle East after the nuclear destruction of Israel, was published in September 2009. In March 2009, he became Fox News' first strategic analyst. Ralph, welcome to Take AIM.
Roger, great to speak to you.
Thanks for being with us today. We'll talk about a number of things today, including your new novel. I've been reading your work for many years, and the column that I saw last week that prompted me to invite you was one titled Crushing the Media. It begins, "The Obama administration's un-American attempt to vilify Fox News only increased the network's popularity. But this White House debacle can't be judged in isolation. There's a global left-wing assault on the freedom of information." First, tell our listeners what you were referring to regarding the Obama administration's attempt to vilify Fox News.
Well, the silliness of the Obama, the pettiness of the Obama White House and its attempt to vilify Fox, really by cutting off access for Fox correspondents, refusing to do interviews with Fox, it was just so strikingly petty. And it wasn't well thought out because it did make Fox more popular. Ratings went up. I have a personal rule, and it's one that really every politician should live by. You know, I'm not a politician, but I'm an author, and my rule is, it's a military rule. Don't get bogged down by a sniper. You don't respond to every crazy lunatic attack in the blogosphere. You don't respond to bad reviews of your books because that only calls more attention to them. You keep moving. You focus on your positive agenda. You focus on your own work. But this White House is very, very thin-skinned. Now, I've been critical of the Bush administration on many, many counts. I think they got some things right and some things terribly wrong. But they didn't try to single out and vilify MSNBC, for instance, which was just savage about them. And what strikes me always, although there's plenty of bigotry on both the extreme right and extreme left, the left is particularly intolerant of criticism. Not just here, I mean, the global left really doesn't take criticism well. I mean, look at how Bush was savaged. He never moved against any element of the media. But Fox, which actually, you know, shows like Bill O'Reilly bent over backwards to be fair to Obama. Some others were tougher on him. But this idea that if everybody doesn't line up and praise the White House 24 hours a day, that you're the enemy, misses what the media is about. Or media, as you know, and your listeners know very well, is supposed to be critical. The media is supposed to speak truth to power, not slavishly praise power. And, you know, if we look at the broadcast landscape, now obviously there's talk radio, which skews conservative, no question about it. But in the broadcast and cable news world, Fox is the only network that tilts conservative. And it does. There's no question about that. I mean, some shows are much more centrist than others. I think Shep Smith is certainly very much a centrist. And Bret Baier's first half hour is strict news before they go into the opinion section. Others are more opinionated. But that's it. And if you compare Fox's coverage of events to that of MSNBC, to me, Fox looks very sober and much closer to the centrist. So in the broadcast and cable news network world, everybody skews left, from ABC's button-down liberalism to the sort of soft-core activism of CNN that's trying to compete now for the left-wing audience, to the outright lunacy of MSNBC. I mean, it's almost a monopoly for the mild to for the moderate to extreme left in the television world, and the idea that Fox is somehow a menace that must be destroyed because too many people watch it is crazy. I mean, if you compare Fox's numbers to that of the nightly news on ABC, for instance, they're not that big. I mean, they're impressive by cable standards. So I felt that domestically there's a real issue here where, for the first time in my lifetime, you have a presidential administration going after a news outlet, and a news and opinion outlet, but it's just unprecedented. I mean, Roosevelt, before my time, FDR was savagely attacked by the press. He didn't try to silence the press. No president has been as brutally attacked as Abraham Lincoln, and yet he restrained himself in dealings with the press and even made it clear when Sherman tried to ban reporters from his army's camp that it wasn't going to be tolerated. Mm-hmm. So I think we've seen something that seems on the surface like a silly little flap, but it's really indicative of a trend from the extreme left that worries me. And let me make it clear, Roger, I don't like extremism wherever it comes from, right or left. Extremism is the enemy of our country. So that's the domestic side. But that's only a minor manifestation of a global trend to suppress the free press, to control it, to dominate it, where you see Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Putin in Russia, where journalists are routinely murdered, or obviously the Arab world's regression. Around the world, we're seeing an attempt, overwhelmingly by left-wing governments, to destroy freedom of the press, freedom of the media, freedom of speech. And we should be worried about that, because for freedom to have any hope, it feeds on it, it thrives on freedom of information, and the extreme leftists know that, and they're fighting against it. And when we see in this country an attack on Fox, while our government doesn't say boo about the murder of dozens of journalists in Russia, something seems wrong to me.
Yes, I think what set this off about with Fox was when Obama went on 5 networks on a Sunday morning, but excluded Fox News, and his communications director, Anita Dunn, came out and called Fox an arm of the Republican Party. And was there something specific, do you think, that motivated these actions at this time?
No, I think there is a real us versus them attitude in the White House. It's very, very sensitive to criticism. I've never seen a White House this sensitive to criticism. I mean, Nixon had his enemies list back when I was a teenager, and yet it was never quite so blatant. Certainly, I'm not defending Nixon, believe me.
Right.
But this White House is peculiar in that it really has imbibed a lot of leftist attitudes from, I guess, the Bill Ayers of the world, that you don't criticize. And let's face it, I want criticism from the press, whoever is in power, conservative, moderate, or extremist. We need that. And the idea that, well, Fox was critical, therefore Fox must be cut off and starved of White House access, mm-hmm. it seems not only petty, but frankly cowardly. I mean, if our president can't stand up to a Fox interviewer, how on earth can we expect him to stand up to President Ahmadinejad of Iran or Putin of Russia or Chavez of Venezuela or the extremists of Hezbollah and Hamas? I mean, my God, nobody is attacking the guy. They just want to ask him questions.
Exactly. And it seems like Fox maybe is the only one that's pointing out what you're saying, and through whether it shows like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, and they talked about the Van Jones, for instance, and you never heard of Van Jones in the New York Times until he resigned or was forced to resign, and so a lot of people I think that is the problem, you know, for the Obama administration, is that these people are speaking, as Valerie Jarrett said last week, truth to power, and they don't like it.
Yeah, well, certainly the hypocrisy in Washington and in the political landscape in general is stunning. I mean, I'm under contract to Fox right now, but I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent, and a strong independent. I think sometimes conservatives are right, sometimes liberals are right. Usually, as the American people believe, the answer is somewhere in the middle. But that said, if liberals really lived up to their professed ideals, they'd be protesting in Fox's favor, because the whole thing is really about freedom of the media, freedom of speech. And, you know, my God, don't we the people have a right to know about a nutcase like Van Jones? Don't we, the people, want to know when the White House gets something wrong, when there's an avowed Marxist close to the president? I mean, again, I don't want to overstate it, because every White House makes mistakes. But Fox has pointed out trends, you know, led, of course, by Glenn Beck, who's a brilliant muckraker. I cannot speak, a muckraker. Mm-hmm. And I think Glenn Beck, above all, who's just, I mean, he's a rat terrier. He gets a rat in his mouth, and he won't let it go until it's dead. And I think he has really, really bothered the White House more than anybody else. But look, if you want to run with the big dogs, you know, you got to deal with the fleas. And the White House, by demeaning itself, by cheapening itself to overreact so terribly to a television commentator who has basically been very, very accurate, just seems like a waste of the president's time to me. I mean, my God, with the world ablaze, the economy in trouble, the health care debate going on, doesn't our president have something better to do than stick it to Fox News?
Absolutely. So let's move on to the next topic, which is the wars we're involved in, Pakistan, Afghanistan. You've done a number of articles recently and many over the years about these wars. You call the situations in Pakistan and Afghanistan two authentic civil wars, conflicts of an irreconcilable nature, and you describe the three options that Obama is now considering. The McChrystal plan, the Biden strategy, and the vote present strategy, you call it. Tell us briefly about these options, which one you favor, and how you think Obama is leaning.
Right. And my stance on this, by the way, is out of step with many people on Fox News and certainly with many conservatives. But look, I try to judge a case on its issue, on the issues, on the facts of that particular case, as opposed to any partisan party line. So, first of all, in Afghanistan, let's identify what's not an option. It is not an option to simply quit and walk away and try to do everything with cruise missiles from offshore. It doesn't work, even if you're willing to do it much more seriously than the Clinton administration was. We do need boots on the ground in Afghanistan for intelligence work. I mean, cruise missiles can't bring back prisoners or evidence or computer files. Cruise missiles can't seek out the enemy. They can't negotiate with local tribesmen. So you need intel people on the ground, plus you need forces that can react quickly, strike across the border in Pakistan. Now, that's it. The three options, generally speaking, that Obama is looking at are the McChrystal option, which is at least 40,000 more troops and apply our military's recently developed counterinsurgency strategy to try to turn Afghanistan into basically Minnesota with mountains, to modernize Afghanistan, create a rule of law government respected by its people, etc. The other option at the other end, the Biden option, is to remember why we went to Afghanistan in the first place. It wasn't to build an ideal Afghanistan. We went to Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks to shatter al-Qaeda and punish its supporters. We did a great job at that. Not a perfect job, but a terrific job. We pushed al-Qaeda on the defensive, pushed them out of Afghanistan into Pakistan. But here's the analogy I use. It's as if a monstrous criminal gang were holed up in a flea bag motel, and the feds raid the motel, kill some of the gangsters, bust some of the gangsters, but some of the gangsters get away. And the feds have a choice. What do they do? Should they go after the rest of the gangsters or stay to renovate the motel? Well, in Afghanistan, we basically stayed to renovate the motel. But at any rate, what I call the Biden strategy, and I'm not a big fan of Biden, but I think he's right on this, is to refocus our efforts, get away from the idea of building a perfect Afghanistan, and get back to concentrating on the destruction of our enemies, on killing al-Qaeda wherever we find them, and right now there are still plenty of them across the border in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. And that would, although Biden's not calling for troop reductions, the right way to do that is really with fewer troops, with maybe 20, 25, maximum 30,000 total of special operators, intelligence troops, logistics, and drones, some aircraft, and enough conventional forces to provide security and to do larger scale punitive raids. So you've got one option, the McChrystal, send more troops, try to make a perfect Afghanistan. The Biden option, which is get back to killing our enemies. And then there's the tread water, do nothing option in the middle, which I fear is the one Obama's going to choose. And that's to try to placate the conservatives and cover his macho flank by sending maybe 10 to 15,000 more troops, but not strongly refocusing the effort. And for right now, I'm deeply troubled. As those who've read my columns over the years know, I am not a peacenik. I am absolutely in favor of killing our enemies wherever we find them. I'm not even interested in terrorist prisoners. I want them dead. But I don't believe that every war is inherently a good war. I believe we have to make tough choices. And a strategist asks three basic questions, none of which were asked either by the Bush administration or now by the Obama administration about Afghanistan. One, the strategist's basic question, the most basic, is what do we get out of it if we engage? The second question is, can it be done? The third question is, even if it can be done, is the return on our investment of blood and treasure likely to be a high enough payoff to make it all worthwhile? Instead of asking those basic questions, we're just operating in Afghanistan from a form of inertia. And President Obama, of course, during the campaign, insisted that he needed to prove, he had no military background, no foreign policy background, so he needed to prove to the electorate that he could be macho too, that he could be strong in defense. So by default, Afghanistan became the good war because Iraq was Bush's war and it was the bad war. And now Obama has made all these promises in his campaign. He's going to fix Afghanistan. He's going to have a new strategy. Well, we had one back in March, and the general changed, and he sent more troops. And frankly, this White House is very amateurish. It doesn't know what to do. And I fear that President Obama is looking not at what makes sense militarily or strategically, but strictly at what is the best out for him politically. Now, again, of those three options, I think the clear choice is a smaller, ruthless, lethal force focusing on killing our enemies, not on teaching dental hygiene to village elders outside of Kandahar. Now, making a better Afghanistan would be a wonderful thing if we had infinite time, infinite numbers of soldiers, infinite funds. But where's the payoff? Al-Qaeda, I mean, again, Afghanistan was a terrorist motel, and for the last year or so, before 9/11, Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, was trying hard to get bin Laden to leave Afghanistan. He knew this guy was trouble. He'd seen the cruise missile attacks. He'd seen the terrorist events around the world. He knew this was not a high payoff for Afghanistan. Freudian slip. Osama bin Laden kept delaying and making excuses why he couldn't leave Afghanistan yet. Then you had 9/11, and it was all over. And for now, in Pakistan, Al-Qaeda and Taliban do have an alliance of necessity, but when people tell you that if we don't make Afghanistan perfect, Al-Qaeda will come back, let me tell you, the Taliban don't want Al-Qaeda back in Afghanistan because Al-Qaeda caused them to lose power, to lose their country. So we're not dealing with basic issues, but my position is let's not waste American troops for a low payoff, illusory dream of trying to perfect Afghanistan and modernize it and make it a rule of law democracy. Let's get back to providing for our own security and concentrate on killing our enemies, not on digging wells for people who don't want us in their country.
And what would be the end game in that scenario? When would we know it's time to leave?
There is no end game.
Okay.
That's the difficult thing about the kind of war we're facing. And one more reason why I don't want us bogged down in Afghanistan. We're facing a highly mobile, highly determined enemy. Now, Al-Qaeda has lost a lot of credibility in the Arab world with their atrocities. They made the terrible mistake in Iraq of when Al-Qaeda declared Iraq its central front on the war against us. It was a dreadful strategic decision because Al-Qaeda's atrocities in Iraq led the Iraqi people to turn on Al-Qaeda. Millions of Sunni Muslims rejected Al-Qaeda, which claimed to be their champion, and they came over to us. I mean, in Iraq, the surge helped, but the crucial thing that turned Iraq around, to the extent it's been turned around, was Al-Qaeda's barbarity. Remember, after September 11, 2001, Arabs were dancing in the streets. Osama bin Laden was a hero. Because of their monstrous behavior in Iraq and elsewhere, Al-Qaeda is not welcome today in a single Arab state. Not one. It's got some people in Yemen, in the Badlands, that can't be controlled, but they're not welcomed by the government. Al-Qaeda is on the run. That's the good news. The bad news is this extremist Islam, generated by Saudi Wahhabis in the beginning and still sustained by Wahhabi fanaticism, Islamist fanaticism isn't going to just go away, no matter what we do, because greater Middle East is so utterly broken, so inept, so incompetent and incapable of dealing with the modern or postmodern worlds. And the jealousy, the dislocation, the humiliation, the hatred, all of it homemade, by the way, in the Middle East, not our fault, is going to continue to generate terrorists. So what we need to do is accept the fact that this is a very long commitment. That means marshaling our resources. You can't send all the troops everywhere all the time. You have to decide which interventions really matter. What must we do as opposed to what would be nice to do? And so in Afghanistan, I think we'll have a troop presence of some kind there indefinitely. I think it should be much smaller and focused on our enemies, because even if we were able to rebuild Afghanistan 100%, make it, Wisconsin or Minnesota, so what? Afghanistan's not the problem. Afghan real estate is worth nothing. Our enemy is mobile. We have to be mobile. We can't tie our troops down in a medieval country where there's no payoff. Now, and if you look beyond that, even if there were some value in our vain attempt to turn Afghanistan into, again, Minnesota with mountains, you have to look at the evidence on the ground. Those people who call for sending more troops, and I'm a soldier, I want to kill our enemies, but I want to do it smartly. And when you hear these calls for, oh, we must send more troops, They're not always, but usually by people who haven't served in the military and who don't have kids in the military. But also, they're not looking at the evidence on the ground. As we sent more troops, and NATO sent more troops to Afghanistan, resistance increased. As we sent more troops to Afghanistan, the Taliban's appeal to Afghans increased. Now, that should tell us something. And it also should tell us something that after 8 years of the expenditure of our blood and treasure in an effort to modernize Afghanistan and produce a rule of law government that people will respect, what we have is the infinitely corrupt, incompetent Karzai government, and the proof of what Afghans want is very straightforward. Most Afghans, you got to talk about most people, there are always exceptions. As time has gone by, the Taliban have found it ever easier to recruit, and they are fielding people, Afghans, willing to do battle with the most powerful army in history, most capable military in history, who are willing to strap on suicide bombs and go up against us. They are committed literally unto death, but we can't get Afghans in the army or police in significant numbers to fight for their own country. In other words, look, what is the empirical evidence? What is the hard data, the irrefutable data? The data is the Taliban has no end of volunteers willing to die for its cause, and the Karzai government does not have an adequate number of people, Afghans, willing to defend it. So we, our soldiers and Marines and Navy corpsmen, are defending a woefully corrupt government that Afghans themselves don't respect. Now, how is that supposed to end well? And we're now told that, well, Karzai is going to reform. My God, I mean, give me a break. There's no way this Karzai government can reform itself. It's so thoroughly corrupt.
I want to get into your book for a few minutes.
Well, that's kind of you. Afghanistan obviously means a lot to me because we have soldiers and Marines dying for nothing, in my view.
No, we do. Unfortunately, we have some time restraints. I'd love to keep going on, but...
Perhaps another time.
Right. The War After Armageddon is, again, the title of the book, and it takes the U.S., it's a novel, I want everyone to know, which takes the U.S. armed forces back to the Middle East after the nuclear destruction of Israel. Just came out in September. Why don't you tell us what you want us to know about the book? Let me first say that people can find it on Amazon, or there's
sure.
a link
all
to
the
it,
major bookstores.
And all the major bookstores, or there's a link to it on the page for this episode of Take Aim on Blog Talk Radio, and there's an icon of the book, and you can click on it there, and that'll take you through to Amazon. So go ahead and tell us about it.
Well, sure. Well, I've written, of course, nonfiction and fiction over the years, and this I did this as a novel because, first of all, I love writing novels. It's my true love. But also, the advent of Iranian nuclear capability worries me deeply. And I can write columns about it and essays about it in the New York Post or in military journals, and I reach a certain number of people. But when you tell a story, when you put something into a human context, when you tell it, and this is a thriller, it's a page-turner, when you dramatize what could happen, worst case, if Iran were to get nuclear weapons and use them, it brings it home because you're talking about characters that people can identify with, human fates. And storytelling is a tradition of humanity that goes back to the caves. I mean, the novelist ancestors are those guys sitting around a campfire saying, and that mammoth was this big. And so I like to tell stories, but stories with a point. And there, beyond the page-turning, thrilling, slam-bang action of this book, there are three messages. One is, if the Iranians get nukes, madmen may use them, and the second, third, and fourth order effects wouldn't be confined to Israel and neighboring countries. Second, I'm troubled by fanaticism in every religion, and this book dramatizes what can happen if uncontained fanaticism spreads like a contagion. And finally, it deals with some very real problems our military has with our over-reliance on satellites for communications, weapons, guidance, etc. In a post-nuclear environment or a nuclear environment, a lot of that stuff just doesn't work. and you're back to a longer range version of World War II. So it's an action-packed thriller, hopefully a well-written one, but with a message. So it's a book people can read and enjoy. You can read it on an airplane, read it in the bathtub, but you also get some real food for thought in there, and that's always important to me.
There's a wonderful review on it from Jerry Morlock, the editor-in-chief of Armchair General. So tell people one last time, Amazon or any of the major bookstores.
Yeah, the major bookstores, independent bookstores. It's easy to get. The War After Armageddon. And I understand that if they buy it and don't like it, you will give them their money back. Is that correct?
Well, okay, on a limited basis. So let's see. And also, I urge people to read the articles that Ralph has written. If you go to NYPost.com and go to the opinion section, you'll find a whole archive of his wonderful articles. And Ralph, it's been a great pleasure having you on Take Aim today. And we will be in touch, and hopefully we'll have you back on to talk some more about this, okay?
God willing, and the crypto rise.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye. Next, we're going to go into a couple of interviews that I did yesterday in the aftermath of the elections. We talked to a couple of congressmen, and we're going to get into that in a second. It's really the coverage of the elections has been very interesting. There's been kind of an effort to distance President Obama from any of the results, particularly in New Jersey and Virginia. But last night on MSNBC, they were trying to make it like the only important election that took place was the 23rd District of New York, which was quite an anomaly, actually. But so we're going to first hear Representative Bob Goodlatte of Virginia. He was an attorney. He represents the 6th district, and we talk about health care and the elections. And without further ado, here is that.
Hello.
Hi, Representative Goodlatte.
Yes, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. This is Roger Aronoff with Accuracy in Media, and our show is called Take Aim on Blog Talk Radio. I appreciate your being with us.
Oh, delighted to be with you, and I'm familiar with your good work.
Thank you. Well, I suppose it's a good day to be a Republican from Virginia. Why don't you describe the scope of yesterday's victory?
Well, it's a very exciting day. The rest of the country now knows, we had a big win in our governor's race, not just a win, but a landslide of larger proportions than I think either party has seen in winning a governor's race in many, many years. I'm not sure when the last time a candidate exceeded 58% of the vote, but that is a huge win for Bob McDonnell. His running mates, Bill Bowling, our lieutenant governor, and Ken Cuccinelli, our candidate for attorney general, had similarly impressive numbers, not quite as high, but I think Ken Cuccinelli was above 57% and Bill Bowling above 56%. So they ran as a team, and they won as a team in an impressive fashion. They pulled in many, many new members of the Virginia House of Delegates, which the entire House was also up for re-election, and there was a 6-seat gain there. So we're very excited about that. And what we're really hoping is that it sends a message here in Washington regarding the dissatisfaction of the voters with regard to the president's agenda and Speaker Pelosi's agenda, that we hope will cause them to reconsider.
Yeah, what is the lesson of yesterday for the Republicans going into 2010?
Well, historically, Virginia has been a state which has, one of two states, New Jersey, the other, that has their governor's race a year after our president is elected. They're the only two states that do that. And it really is an opportunity for the voters to express their view. It's in many ways viewed by many people as a referendum on the agenda of the administration. And as a result, this sends a pretty strong message, I think, here in Washington that this health care legislation that is poised on the brink of being brought to the floor for a vote is very, very skeptically viewed by a great many people. That's certainly true of my constituents. It's certainly true across Virginia. And not to take anything away from Bob McDonald's win, he ran with one of the most experienced teams ever running for office, and he ran a great campaign. But there's also no doubt that there was an obvious desire on the part of a great many people to turn out at the polls to express their concern about health care, about cap and trade, about card check legislation, all of these things that are on an agenda that the public disapproves of, and out-of-control government spending tops that list.
Are there any lessons to be learned as far as whether the party should move more toward the middle, toward sort of a moderate point of view, or sort of more toward harnessing the energy of the Tea Party movement and kind of go more to its conservative roots?
I think the most important thing to draw from this election is to stand on principle. I think that Bob McDonald showed that, and I think that the public it responded to that. They saw him as an opportunity. He at every stop repeated his opposition. He was very clear in stating that he was opposed to this massive government takeover of health care in this country. He was opposed to cap and trade legislation, ran very extensively on that, particularly in Southwest Virginia, my part of the state. And I think people responded to that more than anything else. He is a conservative Republican leader, and I don't think he backed away from his principles. But he also, as an effective legislator and now as our governor-elect, recognizes that in order to get things done, you have to build consensus, not only with fellow legislators and others in public office, but also with regard to the public at large. And the Democratic majority here in Congress has simply failed to do that. They have simply said, we've got a big majority, we're going to do what we want to do, regardless of whether the American people respect that or not. And I think that is the lesson to take away from this, that you really need to try to build consensus if you're going to try to accomplish change. And there are reforms to our health care system that I think virtually every Republican in the Congress supports, that the vast majority of the public supports, and a great many Democrats would support as well, that would be, I think, far more readily accepted by the public, dealing with things like the ability to buy health insurance across state lines, dealing with defensive medicine, trying to cut back on that by reforming our medical liability, our tort liability system, dealing with treating everybody fairly in the process of trying to buy health insurance, making sure that individuals and small businesses get the same tax deductibility that the largest corporations do, making sure that individuals can go into large pools to negotiate their health insurance premiums rather than having an individual or a small business going up against some of the largest companies in the world to negotiate the premiums on their health insurance. They need to be able to get into a group of 50,000 or 100,000 people. Those are all ideas, and along with dealing with pre-existing condition exclusions and portability of health insurance, those are all ideas that have broad public acceptance and support and could be the basis of a very targeted health care reform bill that I think would do a lot to hold down the cost of health insurance and make it available to more people without this idea that government needs to step in, over-regulate this industry, and try to extend it in ways and in fashions that are just so complicated that the public finds it mind-boggling.
Yeah, and the Republicans have consolidated most of those ideas into a piece of alternative legislation. Let me ask you, combined with the fact that Harry Reid announced yesterday that the Senate wasn't likely to vote on health care this year, and the overall Republican strength shown yesterday in the elections, what are the implications for the current health care legislation that's going through Congress? Will House members, sort of the blue dogs, be willing to walk the plank on this, knowing that the Senate's not going to be getting to it for quite a while?
Well, over the last few weeks, I've had an opportunity to talk to a great many Democrats in the House who are very concerned about this. Some have flat out said they are simply not going to vote for this legislation. Others are deeply troubled, and you can tell they would prefer not to have to vote on this legislation. I haven't had the opportunity to talk to any this morning after the outcomes of the races in Virginia and New Jersey, but I would think that they would be considering it even more carefully now. On the other hand, let me just say that recognizing the need for health care reform, given the fact that health insurance premiums are rising at a, you know, a much higher rate than the rate of inflation, we would be missing an opportunity not to pass a bill like the one I just described that the Republican leader John Boehner and many others in the House are rallying around, that would do some common sense reforms for health care, because the public attention and interest is very high. And here, I think, is a real test for President Obama and Speaker Pelosi. Are you simply going to try to jam something down the throats of people that they don't want, or are you willing to say, let's try a more modest approach, but one that has real, tangible reforms that people want, and see how far we get down the road with that? I think that the public would respond very favorably to that approach. So far, I've seen nothing like that, and I'm afraid that we're going to squander an opportunity to do some good in this area.
So what do you predict is going to happen on the Pelosi health care legislation?
Well, to my knowledge, they have not yet filed their manager's amendment. This is the amendment that will contain all the changes they're making as they negotiate with individuals to try to... Oh, I'm now told they did file it last night. So
yes.
That indicates that they could bring this up for a vote as early as Saturday.
Right.
And we'll just have to wait and see whether they're really serious about doing that.
Okay. A couple other quick things I want to touch on. One of your legislative priorities has been to ensure that the Internet is free from regulatory burdens. And we at AIM are very concerned about the recent pronouncements on so-called net neutrality, that it's really a backdoor entry into a fairness doctrine for the Internet. Are you going to be able to do anything to block this? I mean, what do you see as the fate of this regulation? I know it's not legislation, but what do you think is going to happen on that front?
Well, you know, having open access to the Internet, making sure that our antitrust laws are followed and that businesses and individuals that want full and fair access to the Internet have it is an important principle that I support. However, that should be done within the context of our antitrust laws and not with a whole new massive body of regulations of the Internet, which is such a free and open form of communications, to have the FCC step in and write massive amounts of regulations are going to have many unintended consequences. The first of which will probably be a concern upon the part of those people who are interested in investing in rolling out more high-speed broadband Internet access and investing in the infrastructure of the Internet, concern that they won't be able to get a return on their investment, and therefore this will have quite the opposite of effect of what's intended. The law of unintended consequences is very strong when you're talking about government bureaucracy and regulations, and it concerns me that the FCC would think that they even have authority to do what they're talking about doing, given what limited language there is in existing law upon which to base the idea that they could write massive regulations about net neutrality.
Do you think it can be blocked?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of work to be done here. The first thing we have to do is make the case that this is something that Congress should be looking at, not an administrative bureaucracy. And once we get to that point, then I think we can look at the fact that the Internet is very open to people today, and simply assuring that the existing rules of the road protect against a change in that that would limit people's access to the Internet.
And your ranking member on Judiciary, Lamar Smith, spoke at our recent 40th anniversary conference, and he's part of the Media Bias Caucus and doesn't hesitate to criticize the media. I was wondering if you're aware of his work in that area and if you have any favorite recent examples of media bias.
Yeah, in fact, I serve on that caucus with Lamar, and he is very, very good at pointing out on a weekly basis the evidence of the lack of reporting of various examples of types of media bias. It is really striking sometimes when you compare things being done by the Obama administration and how the media covers that with things that have been done by previous administrations, particularly the last administration of President Bush. And it's very concerning that we have a situation where the media is dominated by a viewpoint and feels obliged to make that viewpoint not just, you know, the avenue for expression, like we're doing right now on your program, but the agenda of the broadcasters, of the journalists who are involved in running that media operation.
Any one specific example come to mind?
Not right at this moment.
Okay. Well, listen, I've taken your time. I thank you so much for being with us today, and best of luck to you.
Great. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Now we're going to go right into the next interview I did yesterday, which was with Representative Ted Poe, who was formerly a judge in Houston, Texas, my hometown. And here we go.
Hello.
Good morning, Representative Poe. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. I'm Roger Aronoff. I've had dinner with you. I'm Philip's brother.
Oh, yes. No, I haven't seen you in, what, 5-6 years?
It's pretty close to that, yeah. We have a show here called Take Aim and on Blog Talk Radio. So I just have a few minutes with you, so let's get started. What will yesterday's Republican victories mean for the 2010 elections?
The way I see it is it's a universally American movement to tell government to quit being so intrusive into the lives of the people. And whether it's in New Jersey, of all places, or Virginia, or in local elections that took place yesterday, American public understands it, they get it, and they want the federal government, especially the federal government, to be more responsive to what they want rather than the government continuing to tell the people what to do.
Any national lessons to be drawn in the sense of some are arguing, well, this shows us that the Republicans need to move toward the center, be more moderate, or others are saying we need, you know, they need to harness the sort of the energy of the Tea Party movement, sort of return to the conservative roots. Do you see a lesson to be drawn there either way?
Yes, I think it's a movement of people in the country who are conservatives, and they certainly don't feel that the Democrat Party paying attention to conservatives, and they are also frustrated with Republicans because so often Republicans have been nothing more than Democrat light, and people don't like that. The Tea Party movement has started because of that, and Republicans need to get back to the basic Reagan conservative beliefs and advocate those rather than trying to be middle of the road, things to all people. That got us in trouble. That's why we got kicked out of the that's why the House of Representatives was turned over to the Democrats, because there were too many moderate Republicans who didn't stand their ground, and so they were turned out.
The Republican strength that we saw yesterday, combined with the fact that Harry Reid pretty much announced that there won't be a health care vote in the Senate before the end of the year, what are the implications for health care legislation?
I'm glad to see that the Senate is not going to take it up because they can't agree on what to do. They've had that problem the whole time with their bill. The House, however, we're thinking we're going to get a vote maybe as early as Friday or Saturday of this week on the new massive government takeover of the health care system, a 2,000-page bill plus another several hundred-page amendment. So the House may do the same thing it did in cap and trade, vote on it, and nothing happens in the Senate.
You don't think they might, some people might be a little more cautious than they otherwise would have been based on the results of the election and the fact that they know the Senate's not prepared to walk the same plank?
I think it's exactly what's the issue. The blue dog Democrats who've really just been barking all year, they haven't really voted conservative or moderate, they're in a real fix. Now they have to choose between doing what the Speaker of the House tells them to do or doing what the people back home want them to do, and they better respond to their constituents because, you know, people put them in office and they can take them out.
It's been my view, I'm wondering what you think, that the dirty little secret of this whole health care legislation process is that Obama, by just sort of turning it over to Congress to do it, he doesn't really care what ends up being in the bill because it's going to create all these new bureaucracies. And then basically the federal government would get to write all the rules and regulations for the various bureaucracies. So it almost doesn't matter what the bill calls for because they can change it in the next, during the next phase. Do you see it that way? Or?
That's exactly the way I see it, Roger. It's now 2,000 pages long. It creates or expands 111 federal programs, and all of those federal programs are run by bureaucrats. And one of the issues in this bill, because I've read it, it's confusing. Lawyers can disagree on what it says. So if a bill is confusing, what happens? Then when it's passed, the bureaucrats decide what it means, and the unelected government who run our lives decide. And that's exactly the way the administration will treat it. They will make the bill mean what they want it to mean, regardless of what is in the bill. And that's one reason why it has to be defeated, and we have to back up and deal with specific issues of health care reform and deal with those rather than turning over the whole system to the bureaucracy.
Well, Obama recently expressed complete confidence that there would be a vote soon before the end of the year, and now with this election and the announcement yesterday, things seem to be changing. Do you think he's going to pull back from some of his more, I guess, ambitious plans regarding, for example, cap and trade as a result of this?
Well, with cap and trade, their answer to having no vote is to let the EPA impose by regulation those specific requirements under the cap and trade bill. So they're going to do the end around. They're going to have the bureaucracy, the EPA, impose all of these new government regulations on the energy industry. That's the way they're handling that situation. As far as passing the bill in the House, the pressure is still on from the White House to pass something this year. The Senate, they're going to, we still don't know what the Senate's going to do. They say next year, but who knows?
And if they can't pass a bill, what you just described what they did with cap and trade by taking it to EPA and doing it through the regulatory process, is there a way they can do something similar with health care if they don't get the legislation they're seeking?
They may try to with different administrative techniques using the current legislation under the Medicare and Medicaid bill to expand the role of federal government. But they really do need more. They actually need some authority to do this. So that's why the health care bill is important for the administration to get passed.
You've also been a leading voice on the issue of border security and immigration, and being from Texas, I know you've been to the border a number of times and met with a lot of local law enforcement people. How are we doing in this past year since the Obama administration took over in that area of border security and enforcing the immigration laws?
It's ignored. It's gotten worse, so it's ignored. Recent example, administration took 345 Border Patrol agents on the southern border and moved them to Canada, the Canadian-American border. There's no reason to put them up there, so we need more help on the southern border, less. The fence that was authorized several years ago by Congress, construction has stopped on the fence since the administration's taken over. And we're supposed to, you know, negotiate. I don't know who we're supposed to negotiate with, but I've gone down there every time I've gotten to the Texas-Mexico border. It's gotten worse. Some parts of it are actually a very violent war zone with the drug cartels. And, you know, those people on both sides of the border live in fear because of the drug cartels being able to move back and forth across the border with no intervention from the Mexican government or the American government. Border security is a national security issue. The United States protects the borders of other nations better than we protect our own border. And we need to back up, require the federal government to do what is required under the Constitution, which is national security, and protect both borders.
How do they defend those two moves you described, moving the border agents to Canada and stopping construction on the fence?
They don't really justify it. They just say that they just stopped the procedure of the fence, the building of the fence, as far as the Border Patrol They said they need more Border Patrol agents on the northern border. That's, you know, that just shows you how out of tune Homeland Security is, that they put in border more agents on the northern border instead of bringing agents to the southern border.
We recently had our 40th anniversary conference. One of your fellow Texas congressmen, Lamar Smith, who heads the Media Bias Caucus, he spoke at our event, and I know he's been a leader in that, and I wanted to get your take as a media critic. How do you see the media in terms of applying a double standard to liberals and conservatives or Democrats and Republicans? What do you find?
My opinion is that the national media gives the administration a pass on everything. They support the president no matter what he does or says, never question his comments or decisions. And it's national media is off, left to center, very far left. They have their own agenda, and so they do what they can to ignore the opposite view. And if it wasn't for really radio and local small-town newspapers and the Internet, American public would get a very biased view. Most people don't trust the media, the national media, and rightfully so.
Let me ask you one more question. I know you were instrumental in establishing the Victims' Rights Caucus, and also which led to passing of legislation such as the Child Predator Act. Tell me, I remember as a judge in Texas, you came up with very creative solutions, and I was thinking that these things probably kind of came from back in those days when you were hearing a lot of things in court. So what is you tell me why this is so important to you and what's happening in that front?
Public safety is a something the government should be involved in, and the Child Predator Act is a legislation that requires child sex offenders, once they leave a penitentiary in the country, any penitentiary, must register on a federal database, and then they're tracked for really the rest of their natural lives. We can do that constitutionally. Why do we track them? Because most of them try to reoffend. And we had some horrible cases in 2005 where people had gone to prison for child sexual assault, gotten out, had done it again, even murdered young kids. Jessica Lunsford in Florida was the main one. So we track those individuals. If they don't register, it's a federal offense. They go back to prison. And, public safety of our children, greatest national resource we have, is something that all government in this country should do and set it as a priority. So that's why I've involved in the victims' rights movement and trying to protect our kids.
Okay. Any final thought, any final point you'd like to get across to our listeners?
Only that I'm very encouraged by the public, the people of this country, of wherever they are, and really of their whole their age, and to the fact that they are energized and they are concerned about our country. What if we live in a country where people didn't care what happened? But people do care, and they want to fight for this country, and they're making their voices known. They're making being very active and proactive about controlling the federal bureaucracy, the federal government. After all, it says we the people. It doesn't say we the subjects in our Constitution. And so I'm very proud of the American public for being energized and being involved in what's taking place in Washington.
Thank you very much for spending this time with us on Take Aim, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Roger. Good talking to you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, I hope you found today's show very informative. I think we had some great guests. I want to especially thank my producer, Sarah Norton, who worked overtime to make this show happen successfully. And I want to urge you to come to our AIM website. Cliff Kincaid uncovered a very controversial video of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who you may remember is the reverend who President Obama sat in the pews listening to him for 20 years, and I think you'll find it quite shocking. Also, AIM has people today at this rally on Capitol Hill where we'll have coverage of it on our website, and come back and see it. In the meantime, we will be back for more Take AIM next week, and thank you for tuning in.